Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Stephen D. Biddle, who is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. His most recent book is Military Power, Explaining Victory and Defeat in Modern Battle, which was published by Princeton University Press and won the Council on Foreign Relations Arthur Ross Silver Medal for 2005. Steve, welcome to Berkeley.
Thanks for having me.
Where were you born and raised?
I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
I grew up in a household where kind of policy debates and political discussion were kind of a favorite recreation from almost as far back as I can remember. My dad was extraordinarily tolerant of ill-formed, wacky political ideas from nine-year-olds. And partly because he encouraged this, I just grew up talking about policy and debating policy choices, and it just seemed like the right thing to spend the rest of my life doing, too, I guess.
So was it inevitable that you would become a student of public policy and military policy?
Well, I wouldn't say it was inevitable. I thought I was going to grow up to be a lawyer. Mm. A long life as an unhappy attorney doing tax law, I suppose. No, it wasn't actually until I was an undergraduate in college. When I was a kid, in addition to debating policy with my father, I also spent a lot of time reading military history and reading about foreign affairs, and my friends knew I was interested in that. And one of them took me aside and said, look, you really don't want to do this law thing. You ought to stick your neck out and try getting involved in defense policy. And so I started doing summers in Washington, doing internships as a college undergraduate, mm-hmm. to try and figure out, in part, can you actually make a living and pay the rent and eat regularly while doing this.
And where did you do your undergraduate work?
At Harvard College.
And so you majored in political science, right?
No, I majored in what Harvard euphemistically calls fine arts, which sort of implies that you can actually draw, which mm-hmm. I can't. But no, essentially, I studied art history mm-hmm. for my bachelor's degree.
And what was your thinking there, in choosing that major?
Well, I mean, I figured that at the end of the day, I was going to need some sort of trade school in order to do something useful and earn a living, but that this wasn't the right time to do it, and I could figure out everything I needed to know in order to be a lawyer when I got to law school. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I probably could not learn how to look and appreciate visual art without some formal instruction in it. So it seemed to me that this was an opportunity that I wasn't going to get later to pick up a perspective on life that would be valuable later on. And so I did that.
And then you went on to graduate school, but what was your graduate school work in?
In public policy.
And this was where?
Also at Harvard.
At Harvard.
Yeah, I got to know every bad restaurant in Harvard Square very well by the time I was done.
And I in comparison to California, I'm sure there are a lot of bad restaurants there. But that's just the way we here in Berkeley perceive Harvard. So what was the focus of your work in public policy at Harvard?
I wanted to do defense and national security. Mm-hmm. As a result of those summer internships and some time between college and graduate school, I had by then a pretty good idea of what I wanted to do, and I sought out graduate training to prepare me to do that.
Mm-hmm. And who were your mentors at Harvard? Any professors in particular at Harvard, or even before Harvard, who really helped shape your thinking?
Well, probably the two most influential people at Harvard were Al Carnesale and Michael Nocht, neither of mm-hmm. whom is still at Harvard.
Yeah, both in California.
And Mike Nocht here at Berkeley, in fact. Mm-hmm. Aside from the fact that they're brilliant people and thoroughly knowledgeable in the subject matter, they're also just wonderfully approachable individuals. And they clearly enjoy what they're doing. And they just became role models for what a life of the mind in this field should look like, mm-hmm. And how apparently fun it could be.
What do you call yourself, actually? Are you an IR specialist who focuses on military strategy? I want to get at what it is you do as an intellectual.
No, actually, when I sort of parachuted accidentally into a political science department fairly late in my career, I initially thought IR stood for infrared. So
that was your art background.
Yeah. That must have been it. That must have been it. No, I mean, I think intellectually, I study strategy. I study the conduct of war, the outcomes of wars, the role of technology in war, recent combat experience. The difficulty for me is that unlike the workings of an economy, for example, or elections, or other complicated social phenomena that have disciplines to study them, war does not have a discipline to study it. It lies on the seams of the way academia is organized. So if you want to study war, you have to either become a political scientist, or a historian, or do public policy, and then pick this up as your particular subject matter interest. But there are very few people who approach the study of war as their primary interest, whereas for whatever reason, I have.
So what if students were to watch this interview, what are the skills, first of all, required to do this kind of work? And then, and secondly, what kind of temperament does it take?
I think the best skill set is diverse and multidisciplinary. War is a complicated social phenomenon, and to understand it, it helps to be able to approach it from different directions. One of the things I liked about a public policy training, for example, is that rather than teaching you to be good at anything in particular, it teaches you to know a little bit of a lot of different things. It helps to have a solid grounding in political science, of course, but it also helps to have an ability to handle mathematical modeling so that you can represent your ideas formally and think at a higher level of abstraction when you need to. It helps to have enough interest in the subject matter to have mastered the historical record involved. It amazes me the number of people in this field who have no idea of the past record of military events that in many ways resemble those of today. So some combination of mathematics, statistics, political science, history, a certain amount of economics, a very eclectic background enables you to understand a complex multidimensional phenomenon better by looking at it from different sides.
And what about temperament? I guess you're, if we can say that you're something of a scientist, your bug is one of those human phenomena that at one level is very difficult to grapple with for all kinds of reasons.
Yeah, it certainly an analytical temperament helps. This is a deeply emotional subject matter. I mean, how can it be otherwise when it involves human suffering on the scale that the subject does? So part of just surviving in this job description very long is an ability to take a subject matter that's riven with human emotion and approach it in a relatively objective, you know, relatively detached way. There was some of a series of cliches back during the Cold War about the bloodless way in which strategists looked at nuclear war, and counting megadeaths and talking casually about the extinction of societies. So this can obviously be taken too far. And one of the great challenges of being in this field is being objective and analytical without being so bloodless that you lose track of the enormous scale of human suffering associated with the undertaking. But some ability to be simultaneously detached and objective enough to function, and yet not so bloodless as to be inhumane, I think is important to doing the right thing as well as reaching the correct findings in a field like this one.
Your most recent book is called Military Power, Explaining Victory and Defeat in Modern Battle. I'm going to show it for our camera. And so I guess let's talk a little about military victory. How did you come to this problem, and how did you define the problem?
My first job out of college had been at a policy think tank in the Washington area that did studies for the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and one of my first jobs was running an enormous computer model of, you know, imaginary combat outcomes in Central Europe between the Warsaw Pact and NATO.
This would have been during the Cold War.
That's right, in 1981 to 1983. And I would, this enormous 400,000 line Fortran model that I was running, and I would sit there and I would watch the computer printouts, and these were produced on these big line printers, producing stacks of paper this tall, telling you everything you might want to know about this imaginary war that the computer had created. And I couldn't help but wonder, does any of this have anything to do with reality? What would happen if you put data for the German invasion of France in 1940 into this computer model? Would it predict that the Germans would win, or would it predict that there would be a long stalemate, or what exactly would happen? So the relationship between the particular way that the Defense Department analyzed war and the actual historical record of real war interested me and led me down a trail that ultimately created this book.
And how did you define the problem then that you wanted to struggle with?
Well, good problem definition stems from debates. I mean, people disagree about something, and that's what makes it important to think new thoughts. And in this particular case, the debate that drew me in was over the relative importance of technology for military outcomes. From the time I get into this field, people were saying that new technology is revolutionizing warfare, there's a revolution in military affairs, radically improved information technology is changing everything about war. So the debate that ultimately drew me in and became the framing for the book is, how important is technology anyway? Mm-hmm. When you read military history, it's all about strategy and choices and human personalities, and the software of war is almost all of what most military historians are concerned with, and it's almost wholly absent from the way we do defense analysis in the Washington community. So what I was most curious about is technology or materiel in general nearly as important for the outcomes of wars as the defense planning community seems to think? And so the book is framed in large part as an attempt to answer that question. Of course, the answer the book comes to is no.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's place what this problem in the context of what we know about the history of American military doctrine and so on, especially after the Cold War. And mm-hmm. and we as a solution to deal with essentially the politics of appropriation with regard to military budgets have over time invariably turned to technology. It's part of our character. Is that fair to say?
Oh, I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah.
I mean, for a whole collection of reasons, Americans are a technology-obsessed people. I fancy myself a Luddite, and yet I have a BlackBerry in my briefcase. Technology is all around us. Mm-hmm. It's everywhere, and Americans are just fascinated and intrigued with the stuff. So when you deal with a society full of people who are fascinated with gadgets and gizmos, and then you ask them, now in war, do you think gadgets and gizmos matter? Most of us instinctively say, well, of course it must. And the military, which comes out of this same society, I think is predisposed to expect that there's a great technological change right around the next bend in the road, and it's going to change everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's this general assumption that people think that militaries are these incredibly reactionary, conservative, resistant to change institutions, and yet I think the American military in particular has, almost throughout its history, but certainly since World War II, been the exact opposite. They're way over predisposed to expect that everything is going to change because of the next new gadget.
Mm-hmm. And in addition, is it fair to say that in order to deal with the budget battles, that is, how much do you spend on defense, how much will we spend on health care, that in those fights, technology is seductive because it says, hey, we can do this cheaper, basically.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I think the politics of this reinforce the cultural predispositions mm-hmm. in all sorts of ways. In part, it's a device to do more on the cheap. But in part, it also fits very naturally with the narrow micro incentives of legislators. Money spent on good strategy, money spent on training, money spent on quality of life, the things that retain skilled people once you've created them, are disseminated widely around the country. Money spent on a new weapon program goes to the plant in my district.
Mm-hmm.
And the people in that plant understand that my vote on its behalf assists them. So both cultural predilection, desire to do things on the cheap, and the particular way that the Congress is wired together and the nature of constituency politics all tend to reinforce this tendency to privilege technology relative to other contributors to military outcomes.
Now, the book is called Military Victory, and it combines a quantitative analysis with a lucid account of historical examples. And as somebody who's not quantitative, I'm happy to say that the quantitative part was segregated so that those could be the chapters that you could skip. But what were the measures of military power? Because we should talk a little about this whole question of what is military power is controversial within political science and then within this debate of deploying and training personnel versus the use of technology.
Well, I think it's particularly important because power is this infamously vague, foggy phrase that different people use in very different ways. I mean, it has soft, attractive elements, hard, coercive elements. What I mean in the book when I say military power is three logically distinct but interrelated dimensions. The ability to take and hold territory, the ability to inflict or avoid casualties, and the time that it takes you to do those things. Those are the three outcomes, variance in the ability to take and hold ground, variance in casualties suffered, and variance in time to complete, that I'm trying to explain by the analysis in the book.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going back to this question about the skills involved in the work, how did you then set about demonstrating this using both historical cases and the quantification of those cases?
Well, there's a piece of this that involves creating a theory, an explanation, and then there's a piece that involves testing the theory once it's created. There's a certain tendency among academics to say, well, theory creation happens in the shower or through some magic bolt of insight, and you can't teach that. Mm-hmm. You either have it or you don't. I think that it's possible to go a little further than that. The theory that came into this book came from a close reading of a series of new waves of military history that are revising radically our understanding of the conduct of the First and the Second World Wars and are tending to suggest that, whereas especially for the First World War, the old-fashioned view was that all these dunderheaded, you know, donkeys leading lions in the traditional description that just insisted on stupidly repeating the same mistakes over and over again, that no, that wasn't the way it happened. In fact, there was a lot more change and doctrinal adaptation, change in tactics and strategy during the war. And in particular, the following things were what all of these great powers engaged in the First World War eventually groped their way towards and ended up with. Mm-hmm. And that's what I call in the book the modern system of force employment.
Now, explain that at the beginning, in the first phases of World War I, they all found themselves trapped. What was the trap that the great militaries of Europe found themselves in?
Well, this generation of officers had been raised to believe that infantry was the queen of battle and everything else is just a minor support to the infantry. So faced in a world of radically new firepower that the Industrial Revolution had brought to the battlefield, their solution to this problem essentially amounted to use the supporting arms to soften up the target a bit and then let the infantry close. And that produced slaughter in the battles of the frontiers in 1914. And then, as opposed to what people suppose happened, mm-hmm. stupid repeating of the same mistake, instead we get arguably the greatest revolution in military doctrine of all time. In less than a year, multiple great power militaries that had been raised their whole lives to believe infantry is the queen of battle spin on a dime and all of a sudden decide, no, 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 artillery is the queen of battle. Artillery is going to do all the killing. Artillery will destroy everything that's there, and then the infantry will just walk forward and police up the remains and occupy the blasted moonscape that will result. I can't imagine a more sweeping change in military doctrine. Mm-hmm. Very innovative. Really bad idea, of course. Produced a collection of enormously costly slaughters in the mud of Flanders in the course of the First World War, but a dramatic change in perspective. As they observed that failure, though, being reasonably competent officers, they try different things. And through this process of trial and error, they gradually replace the initial idea that infantry is everything, the secondary idea that artillery is everything, with a combined arms conception that the two have to work together as co-equals. in a way that will enable them to exploit the inherent complexity of the Earth's surface to provide cover and concealment from this storm of steel that new technology had confronted them with. And that became, by 1918, the modern system.
And this, let's take this apart, what you're saying, so our audience can understand it, that the modern system is really telling us how soldiers are employed, their training and their function and action in the course of warfare to make victory possible on their side, either in offense or defense.
That's right.
And give us some examples, concrete of examples of some of the concepts we're playing here. You talk about cover. You talk about suppression. Talk a little about that.
Well, cover and concealment is the heart of the modern system. If you're going to do something militarily useful in the face of this much firepower, you've got to get out from under it. The basic way of getting out from under it is use variations in the terrain to create obstacles between you and people that are trying to find you or trying to shoot you. And cover and concealment is tremendously available. The Earth's surface is very complex as a military environment. As little as 2 feet of net elevation difference can conceal a prone infantryman from a machine gunner dug in with the barrel at true ground level, as a proper machine gun position is prepared to do. In fact, very few of us can keep our entire front lawns under observation with eyeballs at machine gun level. There's a lot of variation out there in the terrain that can be exploited if you're properly trained to do it.
So that in a way, these adaptations help us understand what really goes on when the organizational and human element interacts with the technology. And I guess we can conclude from your work, or you conclude, and it's a pretty compelling argument, you know, that in the end, that if one were to go entirely to technology, hey, artillery really works, let's just do that, then if not in this war, then in the next one, you may live to regret it.
And armies have lived to regret it. One of the things I find interesting about the military history of the 20th century is you can look at it as a series of technological innovations that induce militaries to completely change what they do because they think that it's the magic bullet that's going to solve all of their military problems. And then they discover the hard way, in real experience, that no, the new technology isn't quite as decisive as we supposed, and they're gradually forced by the selection pressures of this very intensive natural selection environment back toward a set of principles for tactics and strategy that revolve around exploiting cover and concealment to reduce your exposure to fires and to enable you to move where your opponent cannot. Artillery in 1914 and 15 was just the first of these.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your book, there are a series of historical case studies where you apply your theory, but I think it's important for our audience to show the relevance of this to current policy debates. And so the new thing, the new gizmo, the new gadget is what is called the revolution in military affairs, of which program Secretary Rumsfeld is a major advocate, and we'll read about what he's trying to do in the weeks and months ahead. What is the revolution in military affairs?
Well, the claim is that new information technologies plus new precision strike technologies have created a world in which the military business of the nation can be done very extensively at long standoff. From far away, we can find any target we wanted to find. We can direct a weapon against it with great precision, and we can destroy it. The cliche is, anything you can see, you can kill, and in the future, we'll be able to see everything. And if that's so, warfare will not be a matter of the maneuver of ground forces and the exploitation of terrain. It'll basically be a problem of a long-range artillery barrage in which very precise artillery shells or bombs or missiles dropped by aircraft do all the killing without ground soldiers exposing themselves to enemy fire. It's all done by push button at a distance.
And let's take a concrete example. I mean, the dream here, or the vision, is to say you have a small group of special forces on the ground with computers identifying a target. That information is sent back to command control, which is, I guess, in Tampa, Florida, which then orders the targeting of planes offshore to go bomb a particular cave or a particular building and wipe it off the face of the earth. That's really what we're talking about here.
I think that's largely what it's become. The original set of ideas didn't even have the special forces operators on the ground. We would spot targets by satellite or by a radar suspended from an aircraft hundreds of kilometers away from the battlefield. We discovered in Kosovo that that didn't work so well, that cover and concealment by the enemy could prevent us from finding targets in this way. The version 2.0 of the Revolution in Military Affairs, as we saw in the campaign in Afghanistan, was just what you described. In the popular conception of Afghanistan, a handful of special forces commandos in the American military walk forward, find enemy targets, designate them with lasers, bring down the thunderbolt of Zeus to vaporize the target with a 2,000-pound bomb, and walk forward in the blasted remains, conquering most of Afghanistan in the process, dragging forward a group of untrained Afghan allies who are along for the ride, chiefly.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's a fair. We've recently fought two wars. You mentioned one. Let's look at the record there. I know that you've testified to the Congress on the Iraq War, and you've touched. Let's look at the Afghan War first. Mm-hmm. What does the record in that conflict tell us about the rightness or wrongness of your theory?
Well, I think the record shows a very different war than the one journalists painted in the immediate aftermath, which was very much the Revolution Military Affairs version that I described a moment ago. In fact, there was actually a lot of old-fashioned close combat in the course of the Afghan campaign. In the beginning, it went about the way the revolutionists say it did. We were fighting against untrained, essentially amateur indigenous Taliban who didn't have enough military skill to exploit the terrain for cover and concealment. We could find them at long range. We could destroy them at safe distances. As the campaign progressed, though, we increasingly started encountering better trained foreign allies of the Taliban, and especially Al-Qaeda fighters who'd been through Osama bin Laden's infamous terrorist camps, which in fact were not so much terrorist camps as they were training grounds for preparing people with an essentially Western infantry syllabus for use on Afghanistan's front lines in the Civil War. As we started encountering better trained troops, they were much more successful at avoiding our attempts to find them and surviving the strikes that we directed against them. And as a result, it became increasingly necessary to come to close quarters with them and drive them out through an old-fashioned process of fire and maneuver, very much like the one that I describe in the book, in which the relative skills of the two sides in this undertaking have a lot to do with whether you prevail or not.
And in fact, I guess the failure to deal with that second phase accounts for the loss of Osama bin Laden in the famous battle in the Afghan War, if he was there. I mean, that we don't know that for a fact, and so on. So that in the end, we were confronting if we apply your theory, the modern system being used by this ragtag army in its second phase, in which the Al-Qaeda elements were dominant, and we didn't secure a victory.
Well, I mean, the question of victory is a multidimensional issue. I mean, the book that I wrote deals with victory in battles, not necessarily with victory in wars. So whether or not we've met our war aims in Afghanistan, I think we don't yet know.
Right, right.
I mean, perhaps we will, perhaps we not. Depending on how the Karzai regime's political future shapes up. But we clearly had some war aims in the conduct of this campaign that were not met. We did not net Osama bin Laden and his chief lieutenants. They did get away. Greatly assisting their ultimate getaway was the fact that their combatants had enough military skill to avoid destruction at long standoff by precision-guided weapons of the United States.
Now, let's talk a little about Iraq and that war and the battles within the war. Mm-hmm. What does the evidence show us about the facts there as they relate to your theory?
Well, I think with respect to the question of why our casualties were so low, which was certainly in the immediate aftermath of the major combat phase, one of the big issues, many people believed then and believe now that the reason our casualties were so low was our technology. Our speed, our precision, our situation awareness enabled us to destroy one of the world's largest militaries at radically low cost to us. I've been arguing that you can't adequately explain real military outcomes by looking only at technology. You have to look at how technology interacts with the way the forces are used. And Iraqi force employment in 2003 was, let us say, remarkably permissive. They didn't do anything remotely like the modern system as I've described it. Their targets were remarkably exposed, remarkably massed and concentrated, very easy to find and easy to destroy at a safe distance.
So in a way, the people who argue that the Iraq war in its, I guess we would say, the first phase or the battles in the first phase of the war up until that point that the mission seemed to be accomplished, we can't say we passed the exam with regard to the question you're posing, mm-hmm. because there was no modern system of defense on the other side, and so therefore we're not in a position to say that the revolution in military affairs, to the extent it was being applied, worked.
That's right. There's no evidence that revolutionary new technology makes tactics irrelevant and can destroy anything in Iraq, because there were no good tactics seen in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. On the other side.
On the other side. Yeah. Our people were extraordinarily good and extraordinarily mm-hmm. proficient. The Iraqis were not. By contrast, in Afghanistan, we have actual evidence of what happens when a reasonably proficient military organization is engaged by American standoff precision firepower. And what we observe in the latter phases of the Afghan campaign is that a proficient military organization can get out from under these capabilities. Mm-hmm. We didn't see that in Iraq because we didn't see that kind of force employment in Iraq.
You make the argument in the book that not all states are in a position to adopt the modern system of warfare. Talk a little about that. Mm-hmm. What is the problem there? What does it tell us about the way we measure capability on the other side?
Well, when you look at the particulars of what you have to do in order to exploit the complexity of the Earth's surface to provide cover and concealment, they require, for example, a substantial amount of delegation of authority, individual initiative, and willingness to make up your own mind about the nature of the ground in front of you on the part of very junior officers. Thousands to tens of thousands of 18 to 29-year-old junior officers have to have enough military knowledge and enough judgment and ability to see the ground in front of them to pick the best way forward for their troops through the complex ground in front of them. Now, cultivating a culture of autonomy and initiative in 18 to 29-year-olds with guns isn't such a great idea if, for example, you're Saddam Hussein. Mm-hmm. In, say, 1998, where having a bunch of 29-year-olds with guns feel like they can do whatever they think is right could very well lead a lot of them to decide that they want a different kind of government in Baghdad and end up shooting Saddam Hussein in a coup d'etat. So states whose internal politics produce radically conflictual civil-military relations between the government and their own officers are going to find it very difficult to master the kinds of techniques required in order to do the modern system as I describe it.
Mm-hmm. This argument, and you make a compelling case, is very relevant in the battle over the budget with regard to mm-hmm. Pentagon spending, mm-hmm. Because in the end, if you are correct, then it suggests different ways to spend the bulk of the Pentagon budget. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, if the people on the side of the Revolution of Military Affairs are right, you get a very different conclusion about how to spend the money. Talk a little about that.
I think that's very important. Good force employment, the training, the skill, the judgment required in order to do all the complicated tactics that the modern system involves, is very expensive. Just people are very expensive. Manpower in the U.S. military costs a lot. Hardware, on the other hand, is cheap. It's easier in a lot of ways to buy big-ticket weapon items than to recruit, house, provide medical care for, and retirement and pay and training dollars for a lot of people. So there's a tremendous temptation. If you think that technology is the heart of success in modern warfare and you really feel you need to get ahead of other states in the race to get the critical new technology, to look around and say, who's going to be the bill payer? Where am I going to find the money to buy these new weapon technologies? And gosh, training and recruiting and maintaining all those people is hugely expensive. Let's cut out that stuff. So there's a permanent temptation to take the money needed to provide sound force employment and spend it instead on accelerated modernization that comes in part from our cultural, you know, predilection to value technology and in part from the relative expense of buying new weapons and maintaining people. And if I'm right, and strong force employment is absolutely a sine qua non for military success, that's a very dangerous temptation.
Military strategy, which is your main focus in this book, is in a way evolves from the choices we make about grand strategy. Mm-hmm. I know you've written about this, and I want to talk a little about that, because during the Cold War, when we were in a nuclear confrontation with the Soviet Union, there was a lot of talk about grand strategy. Mm-hmm. There has been less of that in the way of public debate, even though the administration has been very articulate in defining one version of a strategy. Mm-hmm. In your article, you compare two possible grand strategies for the United States, the one adopted by the administration. Let's talk a little about that. What do you see as the goals of the Bush administration grand strategy, and what are the implications of it for what we can do in the world?
In some ways, it's a harder question to answer than it sounds, in that the administration, I don't think, has done an adequate job yet of making some basic choices that are mm-hmm. fundamental to any grand strategy. Who's the enemy? What are our war aims? What kind of end state is our strategy designed to accomplish? The administration has been quite vague on these basic fundamentals. I think there are two broad alternatives for filling in the gaps and for connecting the dots and constructing a coherent, fully articulated strategy in the circumstances we find ourselves. For lack of better terms, I call these two broad alternatives containment and rollback, largely because of their echo of certain similar debates during the Cold War. And they represent very different choices with respect to how ambitious a set of war aims and end state do we as a nation want. You could imagine, for example, that our objective in the war against terror is to bring the threat of terrorist violence in the United States down to very, very low levels. Something approximating a complete elimination of the terrorist threat. Alternatively, you could imagine another group of people saying, well, terrorism is a fact of life. You know, life is unfair in lots of ways, and terrorism is one of them. We are not going to try and eliminate this. What we're going to try and do is cap its virulence. We're going to try and reduce the level of terrorist threat down to something like what it was on September 10th, let's say. No World Trade Center events, but we'll tolerate lots of other terrorism at lower levels of violence. The former strategy would involve rolling back the threat of terror to a very low level. The second strategy involves containing it at dangerous levels, but not quite as bad as what we discovered on September 11. And those two very different set of objectives imply a very different set of strategies for bringing them about.
Now, if we impute to the Bush administration an emphasis on rollback, which I think is fair given what they're doing. The idea, the term rollback is an attempt to capture what their goal is, mm-hmm. which is to roll back all the autocracies in the Middle East, mm-hmm. to drain the swamp, to create a set of democracies there that would then make it very unlikely that terrorism would emerge out of this, what has become a Middle East swamp. Is that a fair statement of what you're trying to tease out of what they're doing either explicitly or implicitly?
That's right. I mean, if you really believe that the threat of terrorism has to be driven down to something close to zero, it's not going to be enough to knock off the occasional terrorist leader. You get Osama bin Laden, but the underlying conditions that gave rise to Osama bin Laden will give rise to another one that's just as virulent. If you really want the threat of terrorism near zero, you have to solve the underlying problem that gave rise to al-Qaeda in the first place, and it's often believed that the underlying problem here is a liberty deficit in the Middle East, that a collection of autocratic, illegitimate, unpopular governments in the process of oppressing their societies to keep themselves in power give rise to a series of frustrations that Osama bin Laden learned to weaponize and redirect against the United States. Mm-hmm. And if that's your diagnosis of the underlying problem, the only solution to it is fix the liberty deficit, which requires that you politically re-engineer a region that's full of illegitimate oppressive autocracies. And that's a very demanding program.
And the assumption here is really that it is a war on terrorism, and the adversary is the terrorists generally, and not just in one place, but all over the world, to the extent that that they form a coalition, which may or may not be true, and so on. But the idea here is that this is the priority. Under that theory, but you talk about an alternative set of problems, putting aside terrorism as of lesser importance and emphasizing dealing with the other great powers in the world. Mm-hmm. Talk a little about that other possible grand strategy.
At the moment, we're in what political scientists describe as a unipolar world. There's one superpower. We overawe all other contestants, and that has a variety of advantages for the United States and some would argue for the world at large. But no condition of unipolarity is ever going to be permanent. Sooner or later, the Romans fell, the British Empire fell. Sooner or later, there will be a contestant with the United States for this status. And an important responsibility of grand strategists and the American political elite is to, in all likelihood, delay, if we can, this condition of the rise of a rival power. Even if you think that the war on terror is our first priority, it remains at least an important responsibility to worry about the longer-term future and what's going to happen if China, perhaps, or if India, or if some other rising power comes to challenge our current position in the world in ways that could create a risk of a much more serious military conflict at much higher levels of intensity with much higher levels of loss of life, and to try and do what we can to postpone that day. It may be inevitable, but it can be later rather than sooner.
And this choice between a war on terrorism and as the first priority and a strategy for dealing with the other great powers to map out or work toward a future in which our relative power remains very high. These two goals of a grand strategy conflict with each other, you're suggesting.
Inherent in the idea of strategy is the idea that your goals are always in some degree of tension. Mm-hmm. I mean, people don't like that, and military people mm-hmm. and strategists don't like it either, but at the end of the day, there are always goals in tension. And in this particular problem, the goal of prosecuting the war on terror and prosecuting the delay of the rise of a superpower challenger are intentioned in a variety of ways. One would be, if you're going to pursue a rollback strategy against terrorists, you have to be very ambitious and expend enormous amounts of treasure and effort in a very risky attempt to re-engineer an entire region of the world. that tends, other things being equal, to run down your economic condition in ways that make it easier for a rising challenger elsewhere to eventually equal your economic power and pose that kind of great power threat to you. If instead we were more conservative and husbanded our resources in an attempt to delay the date at which our GDP is overtaken, perhaps, by a rising China, you would not be able to conduct the war in Iraq, for example, as energetically as we're doing, and the prospects for political change in the Mideast would be much more distant, if realistic at all.
And you're really suggesting, and I think that your analysis is fair to all sides in this debate about what the course should be, is you're suggesting that by focusing on the war on terrorism, we are attempting, or the administration is attempting, to really deal with what they see as the compelling threat in the short term, whereas those who emphasize grand strategy are putting off dealing with that present threat in order to secure a long-term future. Is that fair? Is that a fair?
I think all of these positions are defensible. In fact, not only do I think they're all defensible, I think a choice among them ultimately rests on value judgments that analyst folk like me can't resolve.
Mm-hmm.
Questions of risk preference, for example. Rollback might solve the problem, but it's very risky. Containment is less risky in the short term, but can't solve the problem, at least not anytime soon. So it's like the difference between swinging for the fences and trying to get a home run but risking a strikeout, as opposed to someone who swings for contact, hits only singles, but very rarely strikes out. No analyst can tell you that swinging for the fences is the wrong thing to do. It's a function of how risk tolerant we are as people. In fact, it's arguably one of the fundamental political processes that elected leaders should conduct, is to manage a national debate over how risk acceptant are we.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how ambitious does the public want to be here, and how much of a cost and a danger are they willing to accept in order to pursue that?
And I guess as a strategist, the virtue of what you're doing is trying to analyze these choices and lay them out without the emotion of the moment, really, that might color the debate one way or the other.
I'm trying to lay bare the choices and illuminate the costs and benefits of them each, and to show where the value judgment lies as a way of facilitating a political debate that I can't at the end of the day resolve about what are our values. But I think at the moment, without laying that bare, what we get is a very muddy process of people arguing past each other and debates that don't converge, because so much of what is objectively analyzable about the problem remains opaque and misunderstood.
Now, one of your tasks as a strategist, I guess, or somebody who thinks about strategy, is to be moving on to the next research agenda, now that you've finished with one. And I know that you have an interest in this whole question of the privatization of the military.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing a lot of that in Iraq and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that this is research that you have yet to do, but help us kind of understand how you're laying the groundwork and what you see as the problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, with the infamous incident in which the Blackwater contractors were killed and mutilated in Fallujah of a year or so ago, there's been increasing attention to this problem of private military organizations. At one point in the war, the second largest element of the Allied coalition in Iraq were a bunch of private companies, some of whom were extremely well armed. I mean, there are private companies that have fielded their own air forces, that field privately owned armored vehicles, crew-served automatic weapons, conducting combat in professionally trained, professionally organized formations. The question I'm curious about is, how far is this trend going to go? Is it going to die out if the war in Iraq ever goes away? Or is this a trend that could continue and mature to the point where perhaps 20 or 25 years down the road, we see 100,000 soldier private armies funded by groups of financiers using the financial instruments of the modern international banking system to go put some important economic asset in the third world under new management because it's being ill-run by the tin pot autocrat that's currently in charge of it. I could imagine, in fact, that 20 or 30 years from now, the most challenging opponent to the U.S. military might be not some ragtag military of a rogue regime somewhere, but a private company with access to the kinds of equipment and the kinds of skills and the kinds of training that money on the scale is currently available with the liquidity of the international financial system can provide.
We always think of the threat to the state in terms of international capitalism, the multinational corporation, the corporation that is global but has no real home and so on. But you're seeing, and we're beginning to see, an environment in which military organizations fueled by either legitimate or illegitimate money could become an equally powerful entity.
Oh, yes. And the mental models we carry around with us on this are, I think, very unsatisfactory. We tend to think of war as fundamentally a government activity. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can privatize trash collection or you can privatize dog catching or whatever, but at the end of the day, the one thing that's inherently public, so people suppose, is the military and the provision of military force. And that's the way the world has been since certainly the beginning of the 20th century. It's not the way the world has always been. At various times in history, military soldiering has been essentially a private undertaking where companies were formed to provide this service, individuals were recruited or not to go into some other line of work or into this line of work. The whole thing was done by market mechanisms. I mean, as recently as the 18th century, for example, the German state of Hesse built a military primarily as an export good. Mm-hmm. It rented its military out to various other European countries. I mean, we're all familiar with the role of the Hessians in the American Revolution. Well, these Hessians were raised, trained, equipped, and organized by the state of Hesse and then rented out to Britain for use in Britain's wars. And then Britain would finish with them and return them to the recruiting station in Hesse again at the end of the process. That there's been much, much more variation in the degree of market involvement in the provision of military force historically than most of us casually suppose. And again, I think at the moment, the larger economic forces at work here are creating incentives to dramatically expand the scale of market involvement in the provision of military force in ways that can pose important policy issues for the United States.
So in a way, the one could envision a situation where the state might not be able to afford the military power that it needs, and afford in two senses. One, economically, but also in terms of public opinion. If the electorate doesn't want its children dying in wars and far-off lands, then that might curtail the ability of a state to deploy the soldiers on the one hand, but then people might not want to pay the taxes to pay for the soldiers.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, if you look, for example, at the initial public offering for Google, I mean, the amount of capital that Google raised through the international financial system dwarfs the annual defense budgets of all the handful of the world's states. Hmm. A group of financiers with the liquidity of today's international financial system could easily outgun whole collections of developing world nations in parts of the world that are important with respect to the availability of natural resources. Even in the United States, arguably more for political than for economic reasons, we didn't want to expand the military in ways that would require conscription or other means. We have privatized important parts of the provision of military force by America in places like Iraq that have set up all sorts of potentially pernicious side effects. I mean, for example, the United States has created deliberately a competitor for the services of prospective soldiers in the United States. Mm-hmm. In 1975, say, if you wanted to be a soldier in the United States, the one employer available to you was Uncle Sam. Today, if you want to be a soldier in the United States, you could go to work for the United States Army, or you could go to work for Blackwater Incorporated, or for Triple Canopy, mm-hmm. or for Custer Battles. There are all sorts of other people out there bidding for the services of prospective soldiers within the borders of the United States, and that bids up their price, as would be the case in any such situation, to the point now where reenlistment bonuses required in order to retain the services of our most skilled soldiers, the Special Forces Commandos, are in excess of $100,000. So, I mean, these decisions that we make based on relatively short-term considerations of political exposure and cost can redound to create some nasty problems for us with respect, in this case, to the question of how can we cheaply create and maintain a military with the kinds of skills that I've been talking about in my book, let alone the downstream problem of are we creating a military threat that's going to be harder for us to deal with in the future than the states that are out there in the system today.
So in the end, I guess as a concluding comment and question that one really sees that what we're doing today unintentionally has consequences, and it's only by, as part of your work as a strategist, thinking about the historical record and teasing out the implications of what we're going to do, that we can see the road that we're taking when, in fact, we haven't really made a decision to take that road because we haven't thought through the implications of where it leads.
History shows us that there are more possibilities here than we suppose just looking at our immediate historical neighborhood. There are very different ways to organize military violence, and we may be seeing the beginning of the return of several of them. If we're not very systematic about how we understand the historical record, we run the risk of not seeing this coming and making choices in the near term that we'll regret in the longer term.
Stephen, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being here, and I invite you to come back after this current research that you're just starting is finished, and we can see what sort of red flags you've thought about as we think about the decisions we're making. Thank you for being here. And before we go, I will show our audience your book and recommend it very highly. So thank you very much again for being with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.